TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Gary Naphan, The Future of Orchards in Times of Climate Change. Farmers are not debating whether climate change is real or not. They are dealing with it already. At the 2012 Heirloom Seed Expo, the co-founder of the local food movement, ethnobotanist and tender of a six-acre orchard in Arizona, Gary Naphan, made a wise and moving appeal to value the vast contribution orchards can make to mitigate climate change and resist the impact of drought and heat. Gary Naphan in 2011 made the Atni Reader list of 30 people who made the world a better place to live. As teacher in academia and author of over 25 books, he inspired a new generation to understand the link between biodiversity and cultural diversity. Many of them now dream of becoming farmers to make a difference with their lives, but few of them will succeed, since land is so hard to find and finance. However, there's a bright future in the intriguing task of tending and beginning new orchards on small acreage. In his 2012 talk, Naphan gave credit to the seed saver movement that he himself co-founded. At the same time, he made an eloquent case for the vitality and resilience of fruit trees and the pleasures of rediscovering long-forgotten varieties in abandoned orchards. He begins by listing some of the climate challenges we are already facing. Gary Naphan.
This is an heirloom seed expo, so I'm not going to bash seeds of annual crops, but I just want to say that the perennial crops are more important than ever before. If we look at the kind of agriculture that is contributing to climate change, it's largely industrial monoculture of annual crops, not the production of perennial crops. And you'll see why that is in a moment. The trees sequester carbon, stabilize soil, survive most droughts, and use far less energy to grow them in most cases than annual crops do. So it's not one or the other. We can obviously grow annuals mixed into our perennial orchard gardens. But I'm just saying that the increasing emphasis on herbaceous perennials as well as edible landscaping and the fruit and nut trees is very, very timely. We're going to need this kind of agriculture more than we ever have in the past. And that's because climate change is already upon us and will dramatically affect what fruit, nut, and grape varieties we can grow and where we can grow them. We also have the catastrophic storms. And ironically, most of them are during our apple harvest and our peach and pear harvest. So it's ironic that August 20th to October 20th period that we usually think of harvest time is when we have the most catastrophic storms, both hurricanes and hailstorms. All I'm saying here is that different fruit varieties, including grapes, have different issues with how climate change is affecting them. Nevertheless, it's clear that if we're losing 500 chill hours over the last 60 years, we have something to worry about, okay? So we have that gradual change, that incremental change in longer growing seasons, slightly higher nighttime temperatures, perhaps more moderate winter cold. And then we have what people call global weirding, that we have all this erratic weather like we've seen the last few years in just about every place I know. And that is incredibly disruptive, these catastrophic weather events are more and more common. So last year we passed a threshold. We thought, wow, we got up to 500 counties being declared climate-related disaster areas because of complete crop failures and livestock needing supplemental hay in places where they're usually grass-fed. This year we're well above 1,500 counties, three times as much counties in the U.S. being declared disaster areas with near complete crop failures. In addition to all that climate chaos, we have a little bit of social chaos. Some reports suggest that 30 to 40% of the hand-picked crops in California will go unpicked this year because of labor shortages. Either that or they'll be picked by people who don't quite know how to do them, and the price of fruit will go up. So we're seeing some real interesting social as well as environmental changes affecting the fruit industry. And basically, we need to remember that we will never pump as much fossil fuel and water for agriculture as we have over the last 50 years. That however we grow fruit and vegetables in the future is going to be a different way. And the kind of stories that are regularly covered by the rare fruit growers reminds us that there's, you know, biological resources, what I call biological wisdom in looking at the different ranges of adaptability of the fruits that we can get from the wonderful nurseries that are still around. There's cultural wisdom in the propagators that we need to retain and pass on to the future generation. And there's local resources in reach. So Michael Phillips' new wonderful book on, what's it called, holistic orchard production is just a treasure trove of both this cultural wisdom and ways to use the resources within your reach rather than buying compost or beneficial insects from across the country, how you can do that in your own landscape. So to slow climate change, we need orchards and we need fruit and nut trees more than ever before. And dwarf fruit tree may sequester as much as 28 pounds of carbon dioxide a year. And semi-dwarf and full-sized trees of considerable age, 10 times that almost. Their carbon sequestration and their root mass and surrounding soil probably peaks at about 20 years, even though the trees like apple trees and some apricots and cherries can live much longer than that. But they can fix 5,000 pounds of carbon per tree over their productive lifespan of being what I'd call commercial yields of fruit off the trees for two decades or so. And an acre-side apple orchard can fix as much as 20 tons of carbon dioxide from the arid season, releases 15 tons of oxygen, provides over 5 million BTUs of cooling power. So up in the Northwest, there's now a power company that is paying people to plant trees along stream sides instead of building cooling towers back where the energy is produced. Because why? The trees along the stream side are cooling the stream more than the cooling towers can at about 1/20th of the cost. So those of you that are in have mature orchards know this. You can walk under the canopy of those trees in midsummer at maybe 10 to 12 to even 20 degrees cooler under the trees. And there's good reason why a lot of us like to hang out in those places in the summer. Okay, we need those trees because we stripped fruit and nut trees from the American landscape over the last century. We let other people do the work for us, or so we thought. So we had 20 million apple trees of 6,600 varieties at the turn of the 19th century. And by 2000, we had 3,500 varieties left available in one nursery or more, if you counted up all the varieties offered, including nonprofit nurseries that just serve local places like the Luther Burbank Garden down the street. And we have, 9 apples making up about 80% of the commercial grocery store apple market. So we've lost incredible diversity in the landscape and in what's available in nurseries. We're losing about 75 apple varieties per year in addition to the new ones that are coming on. I don't want to be so focused on heirlooms that I sound like I don't appreciate the new varieties. I do. I think most of us appreciate both ends of that spectrum. But the point is, if we're going to continue to producing new varieties of anything, apples, apricots, pears, we need those older varieties around, at least for the plant breeders among us. And so back to this fundamental theme that we need to recruit youth, not just as orchard keepers or as the fruit chefs telling us how the different flavor and texture and preparation characteristics suited to each of these varieties, but we need professionals in a variety of other fields as well. In other words, there's hundreds of kids, thousands of kids walking around this expo this week who say, boy, I want to do something for sustainable agriculture and healthy food systems. I'm going to be a farmer. Probably less than 3 to 5% of those kids are going to be farmers in the end, but they can do a hell of a lot if they're involved in some of these other professions that provide backup support for the farmers and orchard keepers that do have that capacity. So what I'm saying is a healthy food system needs all kinds of skills. And so if you've looked at Michael Phillips' book, he's really saying that we need to think about redesigning our orchards for resilience and adaptation to climate. It's not just about the varieties, it's how we grow them. And I would say that's true about our food systems. That Arizona food system that I live in produces about, in the five counties in the southern part of the state where I live, what we call the stinking hot desert. Those five counties produce $300 million of edible food per year, but the cost of producing that food is $320 million. They didn't have government subsidies, or they weren't leasing land for other things, for recreational hunting or whatever. They'd be in the red. $200 million of that $320 million of cost is buying inputs from outside of the state, leasing water from Indian tribes north of us, buying compost from out of state, buying pesticides and herbicides. $200 million of the $320 million of those costs are from buying extra local inputs to their orchards, fields, and pastures. And so if we can turn it around and use the skills in this room to say, well, here's how you can do compost that fits this, or here's a good cover crop under your trees, and here's seed of it that I can provide you, we can have a more healthy and cost-efficient way of producing our fruits. Of course, each region in the country has a cornucopia of heirloom fruits adapted to different conditions. So in Arizona, we have orchards down to 50 feet below sea level down by Yuma, all the way up to orchards where I lived in Flagstaff at 7,500 feet. Within that, we have had about 100 varieties that have been there for more than a century. The Navajo and Hopi got peaches and apricots and some of the stone fruits through the Spanish that came through New Mexico up the Camino Real. Other missionaries brought in from the Baja and Sonoran oases dates and figs and pomegranates for the lower elevation. And these have been selected for additional varieties in our region. So each place in North America has this kind of range of historic fruits that we should more thoroughly evaluate for their value today and in the future. And so we've been doing, through the Renewing America's Food Traditions Alliance with Slow Food, Chefs Collaborative, American Livestock Breeds, Seed Savers, many of the groups that are here, region by region inventories of not just the fruits and nuts, but the shellfish, fish, vegetables, heirloom vegetables, etc. And these guidebooks are to remind people, you know, first look in your backyard and your neighbor's backyard before pulling something in from someplace else. We're not against that, but let's take care of what we have in our own backyard as well. 3 years ago, we tried something new through that collaboration, bringing together fruit experts to say, what would a recovery plan for an entire species of fruit look like if we talked about re-diversifying apples or re-diversifying the apricot industry or the pomegranate industry? What would it look like? We realized that it's back to what you just said. We're not merely talking about bringing back fruit, but fruit culture. People that know how to graft, know how to can, know how to make cider, etc. We realize that of the 3,500 apples that are listed in any nursery catalog or online in this country, 94% of those are from listed in only 1 to 3 catalogs, and oftentimes those three nurseries get their stock from the very same place. In addition to that, the average age of nurserymen in this country is greater than the average age of farmers. You know, they're up there with Jimmy Carter and Grandma Moses and all those folks. So we've lost 800 independently owned nurseries. People think they can go to Walmart and Home Depot and get good plant material. They literally don't know the difference between a real nursery and a garden center. Okay? So we've lost 800 independently owned nurseries in the country that were where that local knowledge was transmitted during most of our lifetimes. You'd go to the oldest nurseryman in your area and you'd say, "What grows here?" You can't do that at Home Depot. The kid says, "I can hardly figure out the cash register, let alone the fruit here." Okay? Now we're in this weird thing that we have actually more apple diversity in this country, even with those 3,500 varieties in most countries in Europe. But we're importing our apple puree, our apple juice, and all that from China, and most of that's arsenic laden. There's some real reasons that we need to look at being apple self-sufficient again, and pomegranate self-sufficient, and peach self-sufficient, rather than thinking the rest of the world's going to grow that stuff for us. So we tried to figure out, well, where can we seek out that diversity and make better use of it? And if you look at that old 1925 map of where the orchards were historically, imagine they did that without all this GIS technology. They were literally sending county agents out to find every orchard in each county. The richest area is Appalachia. The Carolinas are where we have the highest density of historic, still maintained orchards in the country. So Appalachia actually has more fruit and vegetable diversity that was historically rooted in that landscape than the rest of the United States combined. California is not the most diverse garden state in the country. It's North Carolina, Kentucky, and Virginia. Those people have a tremendous wealth of things that they've hung on to for centuries, and there's some great stuff coming out with like that, the Old Southern Apple, second edition by Lee Creighton. Calhoun is a good example of that. Nevertheless, it's not like if we don't live in Appalachia, we should all have low self-esteem, okay? My buddy Kanan Routson took leaf samples of 280 trees from abandoned and historic orchards in just three southwestern states and found out that 160 of those 280 were unknowns that were not the 110 most important heirloom apples from the 1880s on, when the Stark brothers and other companies started to do it nationally, that over half of the apples in abandoned orchards are not now known in U.S. commerce. Let me say that again. One guy went out to 280 orchards in three states and found that over half of what was out there is currently unavailable in nurseries or in commercial production. His master's thesis made it into the New York Times editorial page because it's basically reminding us that we've yet to discover America in terms of the richness of fruits and nuts that are hidden in our landscape. Some of these orchards are so overgrown that in places in Michigan where a farmer will say, "Yeah, we have about 150 apple trees out there on the back 40. If you can find them, take all the cuttings you want." And it's like getting into a jungle. The thing hasn't been pruned for 20 years, but trees have overgrown them, and you can't find them below the hickories and oaks and all of that unless you really look. So there's hidden orchards in every state around here. This Sierra Beauty apple is an example of something right here in your own backyard that was nearly forgotten, and now it's back in commerce. And I think that's the kind of story I love. For the future of fruits in the West, let's turn away from apples and say that it will clearly be dependent more on the Mediterranean and North African heirlooms that came into this region with the Spanish missionaries. Were they Spanish missionaries? No, virtually less than 5% of them were actual Spaniards, but they came under the throne of Spain. They are from North Africa. They were from Sicily. They were from Morocco. They were from from all over the Mediterranean. And all of them, once they got here and realized that they were missing their favorite fruits, wrote home and asked their cousins and aunts and uncles to send them the best cuttings, the best seed, whatever, and put them on a ship. And that's how we got the great fruit diversity of Southern California, Baja California, Arizona, and Sonora, and New Mexico. So the pomegranates, figs, dates, quinces, medlars, apricots, those things do great here and will in the future. So if you're a fruit explorer or an aficionado, there's plenty to do. I think if each group in the country or each chapter of a national organization could say, well, what's in our landscape? Can we bring back 100 fruits that we can go through county fair records that were once grown here? Can we get that diversity back in our landscape again? And all those records are in county historical societies and libraries. Who won the Blue Ribbon in 1935 for the best apricot? Find out what those varieties are and bring them back and see if they still do well in your current climate. Support fruit CSAs. John Bunker and the Moritz brothers near Boone, North Carolina, now have fruit CSAs where every week you pick up 3 new varieties that you've never tasted. And people do marvelous things with those, that an apple is not one thing, a pear is not one thing, a plum is certainly not one thing. And then finding these abandoned orchards, going out on weekend field trips and finding those old orchards, talking to the neighbors. Sometimes the neighbors say, well, I was only 8 years old, but I remember Ashmead's kernel was in that first row because it was a spitter. It was too bitter for us for straight eating. And then when I was 18, I finally tasted some hard cider made from it. I understood why it was there, okay? So that's the other thing. If people are given the chance, they realize that all fruits aren't good for just fresh dessert eating. There's a lot of other ways to use them, and some varieties are adapted to that. Again, it's time that fruit growers see themselves as collaborative conservationists, forging new and lasting relationships between growers, consumers, and activists to save and use fruit diversity, redesigning our orchards for diversity and resilience. For my little part on 6 acres, I have 75 varieties of heirloom fruits and nuts, another 25 varieties of prickly pear and mezcal. So we're using our places to evaluate those and pass the varieties that do well at our elevation around to other people of our elevation and get some of them up to higher elevations or lower elevations too. So think of your orchard as a nursery and think of it as your obligation to share that propagation material with others. Finally, I'm going to leave you with something that I do as a blessing and a goodwill piece to all of you that make our food system healthy and diverse. Know where your food comes from by knowing those who produced it for you. From farmer to forager, rancher, fisher, to earthworms building a deeper, richer soil. To the heirloom fruit, the nitrogen-fixing legume, the pollinator, the heritage breed of livestock, and the sourdough culture rising in your flower. Know where your food comes from by the very way that it tastes. Its freshness telling you how far it may have traveled. The hint of mint in the cheese suggesting what the goat has eaten. The terroir of the wine reminding you of the lime in the very ground that you stand upon, so that you can stand up for the land that has given it to you. Know where your food comes from by the richness of stories told around the table, recalling all that was harvested nearby during the years that came before you, when your predecessors and ancestors roamed the very same woods and neighborhoods where you and yours now roam. Know them by the songs sung to praise them, by the handmade tools kept to harvest them, by the rites and feasts held to celebrate them, by the laughter let loose to show them our affection. Know where your food comes from by the patience displayed while putting them up, while peeling, skinning, coring, or gutting them, while canning, salting, or smoking them, while arranging them on the plate for our eyes to behold. Know where your food comes from by the slow savoring of each and every morsel, by letting their fragrances lodge in your memory, reminding you of just exactly where you were the very day that you became blessed by each of their distinctive flavors. Now, when you know where your food comes from, you can give something back to those lands and waters. That rural culture, that migrant harvester, curer, smoker, poacher, roaster, or vintner, you can give something back to that soil, something fecund and fleeting like compost, or something lasting and legal like protection. We as humans have not been given roots as obvious as those of plants. So the surest way that we have to lodge ourselves within this blessed earth is by knowing where our food has come from. Thank you and bless you for your good work.
That was Gary Nabhan, an internationally acclaimed writer of 25 books and a food and farming activist. As the chair in sustainable food systems at the University of Arizona, he works to help build a more just, nutritious, sustainable, and climate-resilient food shed spanning the U.S.-Mexico border. He's also personally engaged as an orchard keeper and wild foods forager on his small farm in Patagonia, Arizona. His website is garynabhan.com. Nabhan is spelled N-A-B like bird, H like horse, A-N, Nabhan. You can hear this talk again for free at TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. Gary Nabhan's speech on orchards in times of climate change was 15 minutes longer, with many more practical details. You can get the CD at cost from TUC Radio by ordering online or by calling 707-463-2654 with your credit card, or by sending a check to Post Office Box 44, Calpella, California, 95418. That's Box 44, Calpella, California, 95418. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654. TUC Radio celebrates 20 years on the air. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.